Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today we have a topic that probably needs to be discussed quite a lot with everybody's stress, depression, and low self-esteem issues. So my guest's name is Dr. Bill Koch, and he is a psychotherapist for over 30 years, and he specializes in couple therapy, depression, self-esteem, shame issues, anxiety disorders, and anger management. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be on the show.
You're very welcome. Now, before we really get into the whole topic we're going to talk about, let's talk a little bit about you, Dr. Bill Koch. Tell us a little bit about who you are, what prompted you to become a psychotherapist.
What an interesting question. Actually, it was basically evolutionary. It was kind of a discovery that I'd essentially been a psychotherapist all my life and never knew it. I started out in anthropology, and I started basically with a tremendous curiosity about people and started kind of with culture because I landed in a very special place in the university I was going to. And then I got a fellowship to USC in a place, thing called Teacher Corps, which was bringing a lot of the innovative methods to the inner city. And then I started teaching in Santa Monica. And my principal actually told me first that I should do this, and then other people who were around me kept telling me that this is something I should do because it seemed to have an effect on people. And so I decided to give it a try, and I got an internal license. Somebody gave me free office, free people, free everything. It's kind of like one of those things where the door is open. And I found that this was something that seemed right. The fit was, I felt like it was exactly what I was supposed to be doing. So that's how it happened. And, a thumbnail sketch.
And a thumbnail sketch. When people decide what kind of a therapist they want to go see, what is the difference between a psychotherapist and, let's just say, a regular therapist?
A regular therapist?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a psychotherapist is what we all are. If you get a license, a regular marriage family therapist license, you're a psychotherapist. If you are licensed as a clinical psychologist, then you're a psychologist based on the license. A clinical license is basically for people working in hospitals or clinics and people doing research. And most of the people out in the field in private practice, like the way I'm working, we're really psychotherapists, but I have a PhD in psychotherapy or in psychology. I failed to mention that. Got a master's in education after that, and then I got a PhD in psychology. But we're all psychotherapists, which is basically what we're trying to do, essentially, more than anything else, is just to relieve pain. We're not trying to change who the individual is. We're not trying to make them different. We're not trying to change what the choices they're making. We're trying to show them why they're making the choices they're making. But what we really want to do is take the pain away as much as possible to relieve emotional pain, which is basically the same as physical pain. We know now that it goes through the same neural pathways as physical pain. So people have these wounds inside of them that they've encountered through the experiences that they've had, and we're trying to heal them. And essentially, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put kind of emotional band-aids or, many cases doing triage, trying to stop the hemorrhaging inside so that people can live more peacefully.
Dr. Koch, do you think a lot of people have a really hard time going back into their basic emotional history to find out maybe why they react to certain things?
People have a very hard time with that. Rightfully so. It's painful stuff. But we're really trying to show cause and effect. And most people suffer because they feel that they are the cause. In other words, they feel they caused the family pain. They caused whatever happened to them. They caused the abuse. They caused the problems in the family. It was their fault. And all children react that way to problems, difficulties in the home, whether it's through emotional distance, physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, all those things, every one of those things, the child blames themselves, and because they can't abstract, they can't make those connections. So we have to make them so that they understand what happened. And then we can move on to what they want to do and what's important to them and what they feel and things like that. So we're not rooted in delving and dredging like people like to say that we are as psychotherapists. We're not into doing that. We just want to eliminate self-blame. And sometimes we have to look at the family to see what happened so we can not take on that responsibility to the extent that we do. And people, you know, get into self-criticism, self-loathing, bad feelings about themselves, depression, anxiety. All those things are rooted in this, the what Leon Wormser calls the omnipotent masochistic child, in the sense that all children take on the family pain. So we want to try to eliminate that. We want to try to bring in the reality of what's really actually happening and who the person actually is, which is different than oftentimes what their distorted view or their sense of themselves, which I think is not true, their personal myth about themselves. You know, somebody feels that they're inadequate or worthless or stupid or not good enough or not deserving. Those are mythologies, and we have to try to straighten that out. We have to bring in what's true, that they are deserving for no reason. They're valuable. Every human being is valuable, and they can live a life that is enjoyable and productive and fulfilling.
So, what is the youngest age that you've worked with?
Oh, goodness. Probably, I would say probably mostly almost always teenagers. Probably 11, 12 would be the earliest.
Would it be better if a child was having problems before that age, that they actually saw a psychotherapist, rather than let them go a little bit longer and let them get into puberty where there's much worse emotional things going on?
Well, I agree, but I'm not a specialist. I think if you're going to do children, then you have to specialize in that, which means you have your whole practice set up that way. And what I mean is that you have to do play therapy, you have to have toys and games and things that they can do, and you have to be able to move around and have a different kind of functioning office than I do. So after working with children for 13 years, I felt that I really understood a lot of that and that I wanted to work with adults. But there are people who specialize in children that are fantastic, and I refer all my early children to them because that's their specialization. And my heart is out to them. It's a very difficult work, and it's very necessary many times because they need an advocate, you know, and they need someone that's safe.
Especially in today's world, it seems.
a lot of the
children that have been labeled with ADD, HD, uh-huh. do you think that some of their non-focus or their whatever people want to label them as could be because of some emotional stuff that's happened to them when they were much younger?
Well, they found that I think there's two kinds of ADD, really. I think there's one that is really very biological. My grandson has ADD, and it was a biological issue, and they were able to treat it with medication, and he's a very different child because of that, because there was some kind of imbalance. There's another kind of ADD that I think comes from households where there's a lot of yelling and screaming, where there's a lot of noise, and they tune out as a way to survive it. So I think there's really those two kinds. One is to tune out the pain and the difficulty that's going on in the family, and the other is, I think, pretty much a biological problem. And there could be a combination of the two. But oftentimes they found a preponderance of ADD coming from families where the parents yelled and screamed at each other.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that one 100%. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate part is that a lot of people don't understand that, and for the children being in a home like that, they just continue to scream and yell, and the child ends up suffering a lot. And then later in life, they tend to have very, very difficult times. You know, so
yeah. In terms of going back to your idea about child psychology, my feeling when I was teaching, and I taught 4th, 5th, and 6th grade for 11 years at Franklin School in Santa Monica, was that oftentimes, you know, I needed to meet with the parents. And when I could work with the parents and modify their behavior, the behavior of the child was modified very soon thereafter. So I felt more akin to working with families and couples than I did with children, because I felt that I could have more of a powerful effect. So I have a very strong kinship to marriage and family, and healthy marriage and healthy family. So I feel like that's really the way for me to be a child advocate, which I am.
Which is really good. Now, when somebody comes to see you, Dr. Cloak, do you always set goals, or do they have goals in mind? How does that work?
Well, it's a kind of melding of the two, really. I ask them what they have in mind and what they think the problem is, and then usually they tell me they have some things that they're coming in with, things like anger management, anxiety, depression, bad relationships, loneliness, fear, sometimes problems at work. And oftentimes those are the tip of the iceberg, you know. So it's my job to work with the more of the dimensional quality of what people are all about. You know, people are, we're complex. We have four or five different things going on all the time, especially in terms of like anger. You know, you can have maybe four or five levels of anger going on at the same time, which is a whole topic we can get into if you want to. Very interesting phenomena, anger. So, you know, I try to really help them to see all the different elements of what's going on that's causing the anger, the fear, the anxiety, the depression, the difficulty with relationships. So once you can get to the causation and the core of what's really making all these things happen, then you pull out the little pin at the very core of it, and everything else, you know, changes suddenly.
Let's talk about anger, because I do a lot of consultations, but I'm an intuitive life coach, so mine's a lot different than yours, but it's not different than yours if you really think about it, the way I do it. Mm-hmm. I don't do it like a lot of other people do, because I try to get in there and try to see really where that root cause is started from, how long ago, and, you know, what keeps prompting it to keep coming up without them releasing it. So, I mean, I do it a little bit different than a lot of other coaches do. So let's talk about anger, because it is different, and there's a lot of anger going on in the total world today. So let's go into that.
All right, let's go. Well, anger, first of all, if anger is normal, I mean, everybody gets angry. It's not so much that people get angry, it's how they get angry and how they manage it. So, and the level to which they get anger, and whether it's, you know, angry, and whether it's rage connected with that anger. Let me tell you a little story. So just a very short story of a guy that I was working with. And he came in and he was talking about being angry at his wife. And they had separated a few months earlier after he had told her that he was in love with someone else. And then, of course, after he got out of the house and he started to take off his ring, he suddenly realized he was in love with his wife, which was a whole complicated set of things going on inside of him altogether. But he came in with an issue that he had tried to get together with her, and they were trying to work it out. And she said she would call him after she finished work, and didn't end up calling him till 11:30. Okay, so he got angry. And so we started talking about his anger, and we started seeing that it started out that he got afraid. Okay, first he was afraid. Then he started to worry. Then he drove over to her house to see if she was okay. Then he got angry. Was she trying to mess with him? Okay. Then he fell into helplessness. And then he felt completely worthless and that she was going to throw him away. All of that was going in one kind of behavioral pattern, and anger was just one part of it. And once he could see how complex it was, which is what I try to explain to people, is you don't just say the first thing that comes to your mind when you get angry. You've got to stop. You've got to stop. You've got to reflect, because anger is a complex emotion. It's a signal. It tells us something's going on, okay? Big red light flashing. Something's happening. Something is really possibly hurting us, you know? And anger is then needs to be looked at as a secondary process, okay? And primary processes with anger would be fear, guilt, pain, hurt feelings, shame, okay? Shame being feelings of worthlessness, devalued self, inadequacy, helpless, hopeless, worthless feelings. All of those things can be triggers for anger, not to mention things that are exact replicas of things we suffered with as a child. You know, you sound like my mother, you're just like my father. Those things can also be triggers, but we have to be able to stand back. We have to cool off, and then we have to go in with a whole process that I've developed, which is a five-stage process, which is a kind of goal and pattern, which I can explain in a minute if you want to talk about some of the things I've just spoken about. I can get back to these are the five things that will work. You know, people can use these things, they'll work, but it's really hard to use them because the patterns are strong and the anger will come in, or the defensiveness will come in much quicker than thinking will come in. So that's why we try to get people to stop. So that's my first salvo, if you want to comment on that. I have a lot to say, so I don't want to dominate the conversation. So maybe you want to respond to the first part.
I think it's real important that people do identify their anger, because left to sit inside themselves and inside their logic brain only creates worse. And then they start playing their own head game with themselves. Right. And then they turn around and they get angry at somebody else because they've played their own head game. So, you know, it's a vicious circle and vicious pattern that people get into.
Sometimes they don't talk about it, which they do need to. It's just they need to think about it first, exactly.
Right.
But then stuff it down, you know.
No, not stuff it down at all, because what I have found in the consultations I do is that most people, when I am talking with them, have got a lot of issues that have occurred, and they stuffed them down, and they left them there to kind of grow and get bigger. So I think anger, you know, like you said, stems from many different sources, and I think people really need to, you know, to figure out where and which one that the anger is really coming from, so that they can correct it as they go.
Right.
You know, I also think that communication has a lot to do with misinterpretation of anger. You know, and if people don't talk with each other, or at least explain what's going on, not yelling, not screaming, but more in a composed way, nothing is going to get solved unless they're composed and can talk through it.
Calm down first.
Yes. I tell people breathe, you know, take some really good deep breaths.
And, you know, I think the Dalai Lama said that when they asked him about anger, he said, don't suppress it, don't express it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't express anger, but don't suppress it. Don't push it down. Get to know what it's about. Get to know what it means. Get to know what needs, what wants, what values, what importance, what kinds of things you want to talk about, you know, and then be able to bring it out, because it means something's going on. So that communication process that you're talking about is extremely critical to the whole thing.
It is, and, you know, I always try to tell people they need to kind of understand that if they are angry, they're much better off writing it down so that they see really where that anger has come from.
Yeah.
And then when they go to try to explain it or talk about it, it makes it a little bit easier.
Exactly.
But people have a tendency in this world today to just want to blow up, explode, and say all kinds of stuff, and then hope that whatever they said is going to go away. And somehow that other person all of a sudden does not let it go away, because, you know, you can say some pretty, you know, mean, horrific things. And so people really do need to think, like you said, before they start to open their mouth. Now, let's talk about a couple of the other things, because along with that anger issues, there is the depression and the anxiety that's going on in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just here, and it's not just your neighbor. It is worldwide.
Yeah.
So how can people seeing a psychotherapist help them get out of the depression and the anxiety that they may be in, and maybe not even know why, but they're picking up other people's emotions and feelings?
Well, yeah, I think that depression is based in many ways on anger toward the self. So depression is there's four, I mean, five causes. One is anger toward the self, self-criticism, and anger toward, directed at the self. It's also about helplessness, absence, and loss. So depression is based on those four processes. Anxiety, in many respects, can be a precursor to depression because anxiety is anticipatory. Okay, it's always about something that's going to happen. So that it's a what we call a misapprehension of a future event. So to get people to stop and to think about what that is, that they're anticipating something, they're thinking something's going to happen, or they're attacking themselves, so they feel this tremendous sense of hopelessness and helplessness and an absence of someone in their lives or love in their lives or connection in their lives and or loss of something that they wanted, loss of a relationship. So these things are very, very important, especially in our society where people are so alienated from one another. And the alienation from one another that's created by big cities and industrialized nations means that we all live in these little small units and we're not connected in community and clan the way we used to be. So we don't have the support that we used to have when there were farms and small towns and people would help each other. It doesn't happen. People are alone and they're alienated and they're fearful. And so they get into a lot of these feelings of anxiety and hopelessness and fear of things going wrong. So there's a very good book about anxiety that I refer to people in. That is, it's called The Anxiety and Phobia Workbook by Edmund Bourne. Very good book for anxiety. Depression is much more difficult. That's more complicated and usually has to be done with sometimes medication and psychotherapy. And usually both. So, or oftentimes both, not always, but with more major depression, certainly.
Do you think, Dr. Cloak, that some of the causes for depression, anxiety, and a lot of things that we're going through, both mentally and emotionally, have a lot to do with the way people eat today?
Yeah, I think food can have an effect on people too, sure. Also, physical exercise. We know that the best antidepressant that we know of is physical exercise. So, but when people are depressed, they don't feel like exercising, or when they're anxious. So, but those things help. Eating well and exercising and getting enough sleep, enough rest, having good connections in your life, those are things that really do help tremendously. Sure.
Do you think it's real important, Doctor, that people really learn how to like and love themselves before they really try to jump into a relationship with another person?
It's the preferred priority, absolutely, because we're going to bring that same process into our relationship. So however we are relating to ourselves, we're probably going to bring that same relationship into a more intimate relationship. Those things are going to show up. Absolutely. One of the most difficult things to do and probably the most important thing we can do in our lives is to develop a good relationship with ourselves. That's what all of psychotherapy really is based on, and most healthy relationships are based on that. So it's one of the major themes of my book, which is called Happy Together. And it's about one's relationship with oneself having to do with one's relationship with another person. So I'm very much in favor of that.
Why don't you give out your website and how people can find you and then also how they can get your book?
Well, I have a website for the book called happytogetherbook.com. So happytogetherbook.com will do it. And if they want to go to my site, then it's billcloak.com, BILLCLOKE.com. So they can get there through my website, which has, by the way, my website has material on anger, depression, anxiety, relationships, shame issues, all kinds of different articles that are free. And I encourage your listeners to go check it out. It's free stuff. stuff that people like. It's been on there for a while, and not too long, but I think it's helpful, and there's a book to go along with it. So I think there's some great material there if they want to check it out. Thanks for asking.
We'll do it again so people get it. Don't worry, because that's real important. One of your things that you have on here is what it takes to love.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many people who, I believe, have totally forgotten how to love. And I mm-hmm. think that's one thing that a lot of changes that are being actually brought to us, whether we like it or not, is to help us to relearn how to love.
Mm-hmm.
Not just love, but
yeah.
love self, love others, love earth, love all of it, so that we can actually get back to that stable being that we originally came here as.
Right.
You know, and so some of the most important things, you have a list. Out of that list that you have, it said what it takes. Do
mm-hmm.
you have any that you prefer that are, like, more important than the others, or any that you like better?
Well, there's a little, set of precepts I like to use, which I use the word cure. If we think of the word cure and the letters of the word cure, we come to compassion, understanding, respect, and empathy. And those are really the fundamental processes that establish the possibility for love to occur. And I think when we are self-critical and we are self-blaming and we don't feel good about ourselves, then we harden our hearts. We throw up our defenses. We won't let anyone in. So developing the cure for how we relate to ourselves and others is one of the most important processes that I can encourage people to do. You know, it's very hard to open our hearts knowing that it's possible that we could get hurt, but it's what we need to do if we want to be able to feel love. It's a hard thing when we've been hurt to open our hearts. And so it's a struggle for most people, but it's the big kahuna. It's the big thing in life to be able to love and to be loved. So if we can't do that, then we're missing something really important.
Do you give people things to do to help, like, say, let go of past hurts, pains, angers, or guilt? Or, you know, like maybe when they're home, or little reminders? Do you give any people things like that?
What I have them look at is we work at it through a concept of being able to the first thing is to identify where this came from, or all what happened, and then that's a really fairly short period of time. Then once they have this sense of cause and effect, they can separate this mythology from what's true. Okay, then we go after what we feel is true about themselves. This is what's true about you. This is what you want. This is what you need. This is what's important to you. This is what your values are. This is what the way you want to live your life. This is the kind of person you want to be. And the exercises I do give them are, who do you want to be? What kind of friend do you want to be? What kind of son, father, sister, brother, human being? Who do you want to be? You get to choose. It's not written in stone that you're bad or that you're worthless. You get to pick the kind of life that you want to live. And so I encourage them to think about that and to write those things down. And then I encourage them to write down those negative messages so I can help turn them around. And so they can understand how to do that for themselves. So that what they're doing is they're learning a process of how to take this material that comes up inside of them, these bad feelings, these anxieties, these depressions, this negative feeling they have about themselves, and then be able to kind of turn it around to what is real, what is true. And then once they can establish that for themselves and they know how to do it, then they're good to go. They're ready to go out into the world and be able to function because they know that they can get through whatever's going on. So those are the kinds of exercises that I do. But a lot of it's really kind of hands-on. I encourage people to write things down, like you were talking about, to journal. There are books I give them to read. One of them sometimes is my book. Sometimes there's some other books that I give them to read. I'll give them this anxiety phobia workbook. I'll give them another book that I like to give to people. It's Alice Miller. I don't know if you've ever read her, The Drama of the Gifted Child, and those kinds of things I'll give them to read and to journal and to work. And I encourage people to work when they're not in the office because that's when they can make the most amount of progress. And I need them to be working on their own because otherwise they can't be dependent on me because they have to be able to get out on their own. So I want them to be processing this material out when they're not with me and using this concept of cure as a way to understand if you're not using one of those four processes, you know, you're off base, you're off track.
Do you find, Doctor, that a lot of people come to you and want you to fix it for them, to tell them that they're okay?
Yeah. And what I tell them is that there's nothing to fix.
Yeah,
the problem is that they think there's a problem. You know, the issue is that they think there's something wrong with them, and there really isn't. So I kind of tell them there's nothing to fix. And besides that, you're not a carburetor. You know, you're a human being. But generally speaking, that it's not about fixing. And the problem is that they think there's something to fix. And the work is to understand that there isn't anything to fix, that they're just fine. I'm glad you said that because it's a very critical piece of the work. Is that I'm not there to fix them because there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah,
a lot of times
when I talk to people, they'll tell me, oh, but this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is bad, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, really, well, how would you like to make it right? And they look at me like, I'm supposed to do that?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you're supposed to do that, you know?
Yep.
And sometimes they don't quite get that, but then when they do, it's like you see this light switch go on and their eyes get bright, and they have this whole different energy feel around them. And it's really different. And so when when I talk to people by phone, it's like I can still feel it because it's like all of a sudden they took this breath, and it was like really cool. You know, I think people need to understand that the one thing is that they're not broken and that you're not there to fix them, you know, and that's real, real important. One of the last line in your statement that I asked about what it takes to love, and I want to read this because to me it's very, very important for people. It says, if you can become the person that you most admire and treat the ones you love with kindness and consideration, you will create a loving relationship. I don't know if people get that totally because they don't want to look at themselves and go, you know, oh, I'm okay. Because then it goes back to society telling them, don't be egotistical, don't think you know it all. So that's a real important statement for people to understand. You know, if they can treat themselves, you know, like the person they admire the most. Because people really are not nice to themselves and they treat themselves very mean.
Right.
And I tell people are going to treat you the way they see you treat yourself.
That's right.
So if you're real hard on yourself or you're real mean to yourself, then the person who's watching this is going to assume that that's how they're supposed to treat you.
Right. And a lot of people feel that if they're really mean to themselves, that helps them.
Mm-hmm.
They actually believe that if I'm mean to myself, then I'll be better. And that's not true. If they're mean to themselves, they'll be worse. But being kind to oneself, and this what we call loving kindness. And I love what Jack Kornfield says when he says that, you know, we're perfect just the way we are, but there's always room for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you kind of get around that whole process by saying that, which is like, okay, I can always improve, but I'm just fine the way I am. And that kind of self-acceptance and that sense of being okay with the openness of always being interested in learning and seeing things from different points of view and being open to new ideas is always a good thing.
You also have a quote on your website that I thought was very interesting, and it said, through the fire, all that remains is gold.
Uh-huh.
Do you want to explain that?
Well, when we take on the project of ourselves, when we decide finally to go at this problem, these issues that we struggle with, this antagonism, these problems, these difficulties that we've had all our lives, there's a fire that begins. And that fire that that comes from that work, that struggle, what comes out of it is gold, because we find that we are valuable, and we find that we are important, and we can live valuable lives. And so that what remains in that from that struggle is pure gold. That's the way I look at it. Maybe other people have different interpretations.
No, but it is a true statement, because if you can work through that and you try to work through that, mm-hmm. then what you're going to have left is the finest of whatever you are.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it really does make a difference how people look at things and how they word things. Now, I have a question for you.
Sure.
And this is kind of a common one mm-hmm. for people, I think, but I don't know if everybody realizes this. Twins. Twins usually have a little hard time amongst themselves. So have you talked with twins before?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Several people right now who are twins. It does depend on whether they're identical or fraternal. Fraternal twins don't have the same issues as, you know, identical twins, but they're similar because there is a strong comparison between one another. Identical twins, there's this tremendous symbiosis between them, and it can be, you know, sometimes very wonderful and sometimes not so much, but oftentimes they really struggle to gain their own sense of separateness and their own individual identities because of the merging with the other twin. You know. But I think there's probably, it has so much to do, I think, with siblings or twins or any kind of process that involves children growing up with one another, with siblings, is how the parents treat it, how the parents handle it. Because I think when parents are very supportive of the friendship between the children and really make an effort to help them and help them help each other and be kind to one another, I think it's very much, you know, something that they can then take into the rest of their lives. My granddaughter did a beautiful thing. It was my grandson's 9th birthday, and she had just turned 7. And every time I bring a present to one of them for their birthday, I bring a little something for the other, just as, you know, just I've always done that when they were little. So this time I brought a present for my grandson, and I forgot to bring one for my granddaughter, and she had mentioned something to my daughter, and she came to me, and she said something about it, and I went over to her, and I said, Greer, why don't we run down to Target, and I'll get you a little something. She said, no. She said, This is Winslow's, my grandson's name is Winslow. She said, this is his day. I want it to be an important day for him. And I thought, how wonderful for her to say that. But I don't think she could have ever said that if that wasn't something that she'd been taught. That was a part of the value system in the family, was that we support each other, that we care for each other, that we help each other. So I think that when families really promote those values, and I think values are very critical for all relationships, I think, you know, good humanitarian, caring, loving values are important, especially when you're talking about being able to develop relationships with other people and developing these senses of kindness and consideration. And when I was teaching, I had 2 rules. They were responsibility and consideration. That's the only 2 rules I had. And I found that everything in the classroom functions as a result of those 2 things. Either it was something about consideration or it was something about responsibility. And consideration having to do with being kind and being concerned and considerate about others and for others. And the responsibility is being able to take responsibility for our own stuff, our own things, and being able to be able to even talk about it or say we're sorry when we need to, or, you know, being able to take those things on and I guess even when we're living with each other, to pick up our stuff and make sure that we're responsible for our own messes, even to that level. But sometimes in relationships, one person just throws everything everywhere, the other person is tripping over it and not being very responsible. So, I mean, even there's lots of levels to those ways of thinking. So I hope that didn't veer off too much from what you initially asked. But.
No. The other thing is that you also talk about your intuitive trust.
Uh-huh.
Why is that so important?
Well, I think people are oftentimes very stuck in their head, and they have a disconnect between what their head is saying and what their body's telling them. And oftentimes they didn't develop what I consider to be emotional vocabulary, where they're able to listen to what their body's telling them and have a vocabulary for that. Because a lot of things that come from our body are very intelligent things. Our body is not a stupid system. It's a very smart system. It's millions and millions of years old. It senses things. It knows things. It understands things that our brains don't understand. So if our minds are, you know, thinking about what our body is telling us, and we're able to interpret those messages, and then our body is telling us what we want and what's important to us and what we need and what's going on. And if we are trusting that and if we are sensing the other, then we're able to then speak to the other person from the standpoint of sensing how they're going to feel about what we're going to say. So this kind of intuitive understanding, or the sense, being able to sense things with our body and using our mind as a way to interpret that, is the important quality. And people, I think, don't understand that very well. So a lot of times when I have trouble with people, it's because they don't understand what their body is trying to tell them. And they're misinterpreting what those cues are, whether they're angry feelings or hurt feelings also, to understand what they mean, and then being able to talk about what they need moving forward. Because I always think that working out problems should always be future-oriented. You know, could you next time do it this way? Could we work at this moving forward in our relationship, as opposed to criticizing someone about what they've done, which they can't do anything about? But say, could we do it this way? This is what I would really like. This is what's valuable to me.
How hard do you think it is, Dr. Cloke, for people to break patterns that have gone on in their family for a long time?
Really hard. It's really tough. They have to be very, that's why you have to know what happened. It's because you have to be able to identify the pattern. So when the pattern comes up, you have to be able to look at it and say, oh, that's my family pattern. You have to know that intuitively and then make your decision about what you think is going to be the most important thing to do. Because a lot of times those family patterns are dysfunctional patterns. They didn't work then, and they still don't. But it's amazing how many people, and it's everybody, will go into a relationship and do exactly what was done to them. And we have to change that, because a lot of those things don't work. And I see that with couples all the time. They're just reenacting the family process, word for word. And
yeah,
it's very tough to change those patterns.
I have found that a lot of people's worst fears of being like one of their parents usually develops into them being like their parent, that they are so afraid. So if somebody comes to you with that going on in their mind, Dr. Cloke, what technique do you use, or you know, what do you say with them or say to them to help them know that they're not their parent, that they're not, you know, have to be that way, and that it can be changed? So how do you work with that?
Well, a lot of times I try to show them, you know, that this really is all you know, that you're just doing what you know. You're not doing anything wrong. This is just the pattern that you grew up with. This is what you learned, and this is what you're doing. And that your job is to not be your parent, not be that same person. And I sometimes will give examples from my own life, if it's relevant, and show them how I made a change from being my father to not being my father, you know, because my father was a very critical man. He came from that culture where men didn't get involved with their children, and they were very critical and demanding, as opposed to being loving and kind and understanding the way parents oftentimes are today, because they understand the importance of it. But for my generation, they really didn't. So I had to change really the way I related to my own children, because it wasn't working. And so I give them sometimes examples from my life, and then try to show them how it's working, exactly the way it's working, and exactly where it came from. And then we talk about a lot of ways to do it differently, what different choices they would like to make, and what those choices would look like, and how it would go down. And I actually walk them through it. Like, okay, let's take this, and let's take this incident of what you're telling me, and let's do it from a standpoint of how you might do it the next time you're going to do it. And this is why you would do it this way, and this is what you have to do, and this is the step. These are the steps you have to use. And I mentioned earlier this five-step process, and one of the steps with couples that's after the cooling-off period is what I consider to be the step called acknowledgement, which is where we acknowledge one another. It doesn't mean agreement. It doesn't mean you have to agree. It means you just say, I hear what you're saying. So getting away from the, you know, the defensive, the critical, the contemptuous, the stonewalling that John Gottman talks about, we move into this compassion, understanding, respect, and empathy. But the second stage of that process is acknowledging one another. And that's so important with couples, is to be heard. So the third step being, what can each one of us do moving forward to make it better, okay? And, you know, that before that is actually developing what they consider to be what the problem is, and then what can we do to make it better? And then they work towards actually doing that. So they work towards actualizing. A lot of times with couples, I give them cues that they can use with each other. Okay? What can you say that is telling you now that will use this cue, okay? So when this thing comes up, you're going to say this, or you're going to put a timeout signal out, or you're going to do a lot of these verbal or physical cues that let the other one know that they're in the pattern and you want to stop and change it. So those are really some of the things I use, and there's more, but we don't probably have enough time to go into all that.
Do a lot of people, not a lot, but some of the people that come to you, do they have abandonment issues because somebody has died, like a mom or a dad?
Absolutely. Most of what I deal with, and what Hazel Barnes said a long time ago, was that psychotherapy is the science of loneliness. Okay. And psychology, she said, actually, not psychotherapy, psychology is the science of loneliness. And what she meant by that is most of the issues that we deal with in some form or another are about abandonment or loneliness or being alone or feeling unloved. And that's all forms of aloneness, of being alone. So, yeah, that's quite a bit of what I deal with.
When it comes to shame, a lot of people carry that for a long, long time. And even if they go see a psychotherapist, they don't want to talk about their shame,
right?
Because it is just so hard. So if somebody
right.
comes to you and has got that going on, how do you help them? What technique do you use?
Well, in the process of trying to show them what's going on, usually I'll take something like, let's say, for example, I'll take perfectionism, and I'll try to show them that trying to be perfect is the child's answer to loneliness. Okay, a lot of children become perfectionists because they feel like if they're better, if they're more perfect, then they'll bring their parents closer. Okay, that they'll get the love that they want, or they'll get the approval that they want by trying to be perfect. And usually there's a perfectionistic child and an angry child and a child that feels inadequate. And all of that is based on feeling isolated and feeling too distant or alone for too much of the time. So oftentimes I'll use some of the symptoms that I'll see as a way to bring it down into understanding where that symptom's coming from. Because perfectionism is always a compensation. You're compensating, okay, because nobody can be perfect. And trying to be perfect is a compensation for not being good enough. Okay, mm-hmm. So not being good enough is a shame issue. And so you can go down into that process. And so a lot of times when people want, like, for example, a lot of people are very much into control, you know, like a control freak, what they call a control freak. Well, control freaks are really just basically trying to control something inside. You know, they're trying to control tremendous feelings of powerlessness by controlling the outside environment. You know, because they feel so out of control or powerless, they're trying to do everything in the outside world to control everything to make sure that everything's okay on the inside. So a lot of these symptoms I try to bring down into a better understanding of where they're coming from. And that's where I'm going to have the greatest effect. And again, mm-hmm. pulling out that pin is what I try to do. Everything else
will
change.
Is it possible for somebody to have sessions with you remotely, like by phone? Or do they always? Okay.
Yeah.
When that's going on, let's just say I call you for the first time and I say I live in Chicago, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and I'm having some really hard issues in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the next step, I would assume, would be that you would try to find out maybe what those issues are.
Yeah. Well, most of the time I do like to see them at least once. But there is this one person who's, she runs a reserve in Northern California, one of the big reserves up there, and she's a reserve director. And I've been seeing her for 10 years now. And we've done incredible work, amazingly so. She's a wonderful person. And happily married now and really doing well. But she came in several times. And I'm doing work with a couple, actually, up in Northern California as well right now, working with both of them over the phone. So I do try to do basically the same thing as I'm doing in the room. I prefer face-to-face, but people want to see me and only me, so sometimes I have to do it. But
mm-hmm.
it is productive, interestingly enough. I can still do the work.
That's a good thing. We have about 4 minutes left, so give out your website and name of your book and where they can get it, please.
Well, the book is called Happy Together, Creating a Lifetime of Connection, Commitment, and Intimacy. And the website is www.happytogetherbook.com. And my website is www.billcloke.com. My book is available in Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Nook and Kindle, and probably your local bookstore can order it. So please feel free, give it a read, give me your impressions. I'll be happy to hear from anyone from the show. If you want to just call and talk for a few minutes, feel free to give me a call at my office, and I'll be happy to refer you out to somebody or give you a couple things you might want to read or look at. But it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today.
And one more thing is that you have a blog on your website.
Yes.
So we have just about a minute or two left. So let's talk about that a little bit, how people can do the blog.
Well, I do the blog usually every week. I haven't been able to do it for the last week because I had a little shoulder surgery. But usually I bring up a topic or I bring something out that's in the book. And I put it up on my blog that's on my website. I also have written a bunch of articles, and they're out as well. One's coming out in Cosmo, and another one will be out. It's out now in Women's Health and those kinds of things. So you can usually see me in one of those magazines, too. So, but the blog is a great thing, and people can make comments on the blog, and I'll answer them. So, or you can, they can email me at dcloke, C-L-O-K-E, at yahoo.com.
Okay.
So that'd be doctor as in doctor, D-C-L-O-K-E, at yahoo. So please feel free out there in radio land.
How important is it, doctor, for people to have sexual intimacy in the relationship?
It's kind of the heartbeat in a certain way, because what makes it an intimate relationship is that it's sexual. Otherwise, you're really basically a friend. Not that friendship isn't very important. It's a critical aspect of relationships. But I think sexuality is what makes it into a love relationship. So it's very valuable to have that as a resource.
Do women and men have a different idea of intimacy?
When it comes to sex, for sure, you know, we use the old adage that men want to have sex to be close and women want to feel close to have sex. So men and women are very different in that regard. Men tend to be sort of competitive and women tend to be very much about bonding. So women are most often concerned about the connection, And men are oftentimes concerned with, you know, being the breadwinner and bringing home the bacon and doing the right thing and feeling appreciated for that. And women want to really feel bonded and connected to the to their mate. So there's definitely a difference in the way people relate to it. But there's a lot of men are getting pretty wise to that and are starting to come through with the value of connecting. But usually the relationships that I work with, you know, men oftentimes have the problem of being able to be bonded and connected to the to their wife. And that's usually some of the problems.
One more time, give out your website so people can find you, please.
Oh, thank you so much. It's www.happytogether.com, happytogetherbook.com, pardon me, and billcloke.com, C-L-O-K-E. So
it's been great having you on, and I'm certainly hoping that a lot of listeners understand that there's a few differences between sexes, number one, and with the way their emotions come across. So the important thing is to really communicate.
Really communicate. So, communication is key.
Great. So thank you for taking time. It was wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. You have a great week. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye now.